This week on the Road to Cinema podcast, producer Vince Jolivet, who has produced over 90 projects with James Franco, including his latest, The Disaster Artist, which features James Franco playing the infamous Tommy Wiseau, the star and director of the infamous cult hit The Room. Vince shares how his collaboration with James Franco began in an acting class many years ago and continued into forming the company Rabbit Bandini and now Ramona Films, which continues to make projects with both James Franco and his brother Dave Franco. We'll learn all about the producing skills that Vince learned over the years working with James, and we'll have some insights into the development of The Disaster Artist. For more information on the Road to Cinema podcast, please visit jogroadproductions.com. You can also subscribe to Jog Road Productions on YouTube to watch some of our video interviews with Greta Gerwig, Don Cheadle, and Ewan McGregor, among many others. You can follow us on Twitter at Jog Road, Instagram at Jog Road Productions. You can like our Jog Road Productions Facebook page. And don't forget to subscribe to the Road to Cinema podcast on Apple Podcasts and iTunes for the latest episode downloaded every week. And you can also write us a nice review on the Apple Podcasts iTunes section under the Road to Cinema podcast. And now we join producer Vince Jolivet as we learn all about his collaboration with James Franco and the new film, The Disaster Artist, which is now playing in theaters.
From researching, you have over 96 producing credits. And when you started working with James on the production company, did you ever have any idea that the output would be that large?
Well, yes, I did, because I knew how James was, because I've known him for about 22 years now. We met in acting school in 1996, I think. And he was just the same person he is pretty much now, although in the last year or so he has changed a lot, which I'll get to. But from the second I met him, he was the type of person that wanted to do as much as possible and not waste any time. And back then in our acting class, it was our teacher, because I used to act, and our teacher had told us that in order to become a better actor, we needed to rehearse at least once a day. So James would force me to rehearse with him once a day at 8 a.m. That was the time. It was 8 a.m. He would come over to my place, or I'd go to his place and we'd rehearse, and I'd be done for the day. But what I didn't know was that James had that situation with everyone in our class. So he would rehearse with me at 8 and then go do 8 or 9 other rehearsals that day.
He had his whole day blocked out with every student.
Yeah. And back then we'd have these pagers. You know, before cell phones, we had pagers. And sometimes I would get a page from him, and it would say 911, call me 911. Like, and I'd be driving and I'd have to pull over and find a payphone, and I'm like, what the hell's going on? And I'd call him, I'm like, what's up, dude? Are you okay? And he's like, yeah, no, I'm fine. Just wanted to make sure you got my message that we're gonna switch rehearsal from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. I'm like, yes, I got it, dude. All right, see you at 9. So long answer to your question is, because when I first met him, he was like that. I knew once we started a production company, it was just going to be one thing after the other.
What was that initial conversation in terms of what projects he was interested in? Because it seems like his range is, you know, his interests are everywhere in a way.
Yeah. So started out, I was still in acting school, and I went to him one morning and I said, the acting thing's not really working out for me. And I see you going on all these auditions, and it's hard for me to even book an audition. And I thought, I'm not feeling it anymore. And before I could even finish my sentence, he goes, well, you like producing, right? And I said, yeah. He goes, well, let's do this. Why don't you start producing stuff? I'll write us some plays. You can still act, and we can put the plays on in our theater, because we were at an acting school that had its own theater. And so we did that for about 3 years. Like, he would write all these one-act plays. I ended up producing them. And we did it for 3 years. And that then led to... Then he started making some money as an actor. And he came to me one day and he said, why don't we turn one of our plays into a movie? And we basically just took the play, didn't even change it, and just shot it as a movie.
Right. Not even as a screenplay.
Right. Adaptation. We didn't even move it into a screenplay. We just did it. And that was our first film. It was called The Ape. And since then, you know, back in those days, and again, up until about a year ago, he had a very, very eclectic taste. And in those days, it was more, you know, it was very experimental. And the play was experimental. And all the projects we did were very experimental in nature. So they were art films, short films, feature films that only sort of like, that only a niche audience would like. And we did that for years. That's probably where the majority of the 95 films that we've done came from. Yeah.
What were some of those initial lessons that you learned about what a producer does sort of logistically and in keeping a production together since you're balancing so many simultaneously?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, back then, it was sort of like on-the-job training for me because the biggest thing, I guess, one of the biggest things, takeaways, was that as far as like spending money, and because at that point in time it was James's money, and I, you know, I didn't want to just recklessly spend his money. You know, it was, I took it very seriously to try to budget properly because it was his money. He would change things all the time in life. Right. That would cause the budget to expand. But I was just very, I remember taking it very seriously, just trying to keep the budget sort of intact without needing more money. And I think the other takeaway from those days, the biggest, even more than that, was sort of the communication that I had with James at the time. It just was paramount. And without communication, it's very difficult to do anything. And off the top of my head, those are the only two things I can really think about.
Did you feel that you were sort of creatively collaborating on the projects as well in terms of giving him input on what he should focus on, or, you know, things that could enhance certain projects?
Yeah. So basically in those days, so I kind of break up our partnership in three sections. And that first section was the ultra experimental stage. The second stage was just more literary and experimental stage. And our present stage is a more commercial stage. But back in those days, his creative taste and my creative taste differ quite a bit. I'm much more of a mainstream, commercial type producer. Those are the things I really like to produce, even though we haven't done a lot of those. So because our partnership has gone on for so long, the reason it's gone on for so long is because we both found what we're really good at in our partnership. And his was to lead the way creatively. And mine was to lead the way business, in a business sense. And so those would overlap every now and then. So I would throw my two cents in creatively, and he would throw his two cents in on the business side. But for the most part, he just did what he wanted to do.
And you were just trying to service that vision.
Yeah, exactly. So when you're right. So it was business and as a producer, just getting what he wanted, you know, and which was absolutely crazy at times. I mean, he would tell me he wanted, I'm like, I've done more. Again, as a producer, you always want to service your director as much as possible and protect your director from all the other bullshit that happens. And I wish I could think of a specific example, but I just remember there's been so much crap that I've had to deal with over just doing that. But anyhow.
Well, in that second phase of films, which I guess would be more of the literary adaptations, the Cormac McCarthy, the John Steinbeck, the, I'm missing one author, I think.
Faulkner. Yeah.
How difficult is it to put together a project where it's all period pieces, sets, props?
Yeah, it's very, very difficult. So that second stage, you're right. So he was going to college, and he was immersed himself into amazing literature. And because he was a very big actor at that time, he had free rein to pretty much do whatever he wanted. And so my role as a producer became trying to figure out how to fund very obscure material that otherwise would never get financed. Some examples are As I Lay Dying and Sound of the Fury by William Faulkner, which are amazing books, but turning them into movies, not so much. John Steinbeck in Dubious Battle and Cormac McCarthy's Child of God. So they are all literary greats. And I remember just saying to James, I'm like, okay, I'll design a plan for us to get these financed. We're not going to have there's not going to be a ton of money here. And we've got to figure out a way, we just have to continue doing these movies in the way we were brought up doing the movies, which is always, very low budget.
Even though on paper the scale of these seems to be bigger, you're sort of still working within that same framework.
Exactly. Yeah. Same framework. Like even in As I Lay Dying, there's a whole scene where these horses and carriages are crossing a river. And in the book, it's like the Mississippi, I think it is. But we didn't have that. But in the scene, the horses drown, the carriage falls over, there's all these stunts. And we designed that whole thing sort of with the mindset of a very, very, very low budget producer. And we're able to pull them off because we did so many low budget things in previous to that. But mainly my role in that period of time was to find the money and help the casting. And I basically would say to James, we're never gonna get this financed unless we can get X, Y, or Z in this film. And much to James's credit, he would had no problem calling anyone up and saying, will you be in this movie? And because it was highbrow literature and everyone loves those authors, it was pretty easy to get people in it. And they all love James. But I really do classify that stage of our careers as experimental, because again, no one's doing those films. And there were a couple films that actually broke through, like Spring Breakers, which that was all Harmony, but we came on as producers to help fund it and get it going.
Yeah, and that seemed to sort of differ from the other literary adaptations.
Yeah, that's mainly because Harmony at that point in time was trying to, make a film that was a commercial version of the stuff he does. And he and James worked so well together that James was like, let's just do this.
Very standout performance right
there. Yeah, definitely, yeah.
Sort of working in that frame, I mean, getting cast attached, is that really a key to funding a project, a challenging project like that?
It's paramount. And of course, in a lot of those movies, James was also acting in them. But financing and casting go hand in hand. And, we weren't working with big budgets, but the material was so dense that we needed, A-list actors to be in them. So, we would never have been able to get those financed without, people like, James and I can't remember who all, but just, good actors.
And Bryan Cranston, I think Selena Gomez was in one of them.
Yeah, she was in Robert Duvall. In Dubious Battle. In Dubious Battle was like, the cast, the cast on Zeroville and in Dubious Battle, in Dubious Battle was Duvall, Cranston, D'Onofrio, Cranston, we said, Josh Hutcherson, James was in it, Selena Gomez. I mean, just an amazing cast. Duvall, Robert Duvall, like you said. In Zeroville, we had like Will Ferrell, Danny McBride, Seth Rogen, James. Just a great cast. Yeah. And Megan Fox. But still, even with those casts, it was very hard to finance those movies. Like with Zeroville, there was literally only, even with that cast and James directing, there was only one financier that would come to the table.
And that was like a Hollywood satire.
Yeah. That was a Hollywood satire in the 1970s that we did for very low budget. That's going to, I think it's coming out next year, finally coming
out.
Yeah,
and I was curious about that because I've been reading about it for quite a while.
Yeah, it just, it's a story about an editor that kind of goes crazy trying to, you know, get through the 70s in Hollywood. And ironically, our editors on Zeroville have gone crazy trying to put this movie together. So, but it's coming out next year.
How have you seen James grow as a director and as a filmmaker over this time? Do you think he's really changed since that very beginning stage?
Yeah, so that brings me to our third stage, which is what we're currently in. And he has this entire, all of 2017 was our year of rebuilding. And we started a new company with his brother, Davey, and we called it Ramona Films. And that's the name of the street that James and Davey grew up on. And the reason we did this was because we finally got to a point where we were tired of doing all this niche experimental material. And through the tail end of the second stage, we did a movie called, we got the rights to a movie, a book called The Disaster Artist. And immediately we recognized that as something that could be unlike anything we've ever done before, way more commercial, yet still quirky enough to be outside the box, which is, we all, one of the themes we still, you know, we go by now is that we want things character driven and outside the box. But nowadays, that has also morphed into being very accessible to wide mainstream audiences, which we didn't focus on before. Anyhow, but so a couple years ago, we got the rights to Disaster Artist, and we brought in Seth's company, Point Grey, to help us sort of lead the way in the studio world. Since we had never worked in the studio world as producers, it was only in the independent world. So they sort of led the way with us. But along the way, James and I started thinking, you know, it'd be nice to do more movies like this. And we worked so well with Davey, because Davey's also in the movie. We thought, okay, let's change things up. Let's rebrand ourselves. And so James has gone from a director that was very, a director, most directors do one movie a year, maybe two. And more than likely, it's one movie every 2 years. James was doing directing 10 movies a year. So it was getting crazy. And nowadays, it's lucky if he's going to do one a year. So he's more thoughtful about the material he wants to direct, and he understands now that it will take, you know, whichever he decides, it's going to be a journey that could last a year to 2-3 years.
So you'd rather put his full potential in less projects,
exactly,
and kind of disperse that energy everywhere.
Yeah, that's another, you know, theme of the new of our third stage of the career we're on, is that it will be quality over quantity.
And what is sort of Dave's role in the company now and his perspective on everything?
Yeah. So Davey, you know, he's very, how can I put it? So he's a very good producer. He's amazing. And but his relationship to James is key to all this, because he really balances James out. Because they're brothers, James understands that Davey has no other ulterior motives. He will say it like it is, and he will not sugarcoat anything. And James knows this. And James has come from a world where people sugarcoat things. And even I, at times, would sugarcoat things with him, although way less than anyone else. But he really trusts Davey. And because Davey has a more commercial sense, he brings that aspect to the new company. He's really helping us guide it to a more commercial company.
Yeah. And with The Disaster Artist, what were some of the things for you that really attracted you to the book as well? Because I think, what was the story? James had read it because Seth Rogen had recommended that he read it and see the room. And
what happened was James was doing, I think, the interview up in Vancouver with Seth, and the movie, The Interview. And a friend of James's recommended that he read the book. So he read the book. We both read the book, and we both flipped over it. And mainly because we love stories about Hollywood in general. And this was a story about Hollywood outsiders trying to make it. And even more granular than that, it's about an artist doing whatever it takes to get his vision across. And that was sort of a metaphor for, not even a metaphor, it's basically exactly what James has been doing his entire life. He did hundreds and hundreds of art shows and video art and experimental movies, and he did not care what anyone thought about those movies. It was all, you know, because it was his art and it was his vision. And so, much the same way, Tommy Wiseau, you know, wanted to make this movie, and he didn't care what anyone thought about doing this movie, and how, didn't care if anyone thought he was crazy. He was going to do this no matter what. And so, in a way, it's about the American dream, about, you know, doing whatever, you know, whatever, it's about, you know, believing in yourself and going after a dream. And that's what attracted us to the book.
Yeah.
And also, James started doing the accent. We're like, oh my God, this is going to be unbelievable. And so then at that point, so after James read it, he immediately talked to Seth about it because they were on set together. And Seth had seen the room, loved the room, and was like, we're in.
And yeah. James embracing that part and being able to correspond with Tommy, what stage of the process did that happen where he had so much access to him to really kind of immerse himself in that role?
Yeah. So what happened was maybe that first year. So the first time we got the rights, and then it took us about 2 years to really just close the deal and get the script written. And so in that time we had struck up a good relationship with Greg, who helped us sort of navigate the waters of Tommy. And in that time, James met with Tommy maybe one time and talked to him maybe another one time. But what Greg provided was hours and hours and hours of audio tape that Tommy had, that Tommy had given him, or somehow he had got them. And Tommy knew that
these
Greg
sort
was
of like
him.
Personal journals.
Yeah,
in a
like
way?
Tommy used to keep a running audio journal of himself, and so there were hours. So James listened to all those over and over and over and over and over for days and days and days. So that's pretty much how he learned the accent and how he got into Tommy's. Because in those audio journals, Tommy's basically talking to himself, and so James was really able to get into his psyche.
Yeah. Well, I was curious, you know, seeing the film now and sort of this new stage of the company, what is your vision as far as what the next projects will be? I know there's like a Shel Silverstein one that seems really interesting.
And the Shel Silverstein one is great. So basically now, you know, our goal is to continue making outside the box material, but more accessible to audiences, way more accessible, i.e. more commercial, but also working with people that we admire. I mean, there are so many up-and-coming, amazing, talented directors and writers that we want to work with. And, you know, that's very important to the success of a company, is who you decide to partner up with. And so we have taken the entire year. It takes us a long time to figure out who we want to go out to as to directors and writers, because we do want to make sure that we get along with them, of course, but also that they have something to say, that they have a very strong voice. So
And you're really starting fresh from what the other projects were in a way.
Yeah. So we have the Shel Silverstein. We have a movie coming out. We haven't announced it yet, but it's on our IMDb pages. This movie called Zola, which we're doing with an up and coming amazing director named Jenixa Bravo. And
Lemon, great movie.
Yeah. Exactly. So she's directing this one. And then we have a lot of TV development that we've got going. But again, it's really about finding people that have something to say to work with.
And lastly, I was just wondering sort of your biggest takeaway working with James all these years, being his partner in producing content for him. What do you think, how have you changed as a producer since that very beginning stage?
Yeah, that's a interesting. I think, how have I changed? I would say I have, you know, maybe, that's a good question. I'm better at putting movies together and knowing how to execute the vision of a director. But even more than that, I think I'm just, I don't, you know, it's, I don't, I'm stumbling over this because it's hard to put into words. I know I've changed dramatically, but it's really hard to put into words. But I think after so many years of doing movies and, you know, short films and art videos of material that I didn't really have, you know, that much interest in, I think I'm very, very lucky now to be in this stage of our trajectory to where my taste is finally coming out. Like the things that I want to do now as a producer, we're able to do. Like the Shel Silverstein, even though I'm not the one that brought this project to us. It's a script. When I read the script, it was the best script I'd read in a long, long time, and I was so excited to do it. That's the first time I've really felt that way about any of our material, in you know, other than a few little things like Spring Breakers and a few other things, but in a long time. So I think my takeaway is that I am now able to somewhat be very, I guess, involved in the decision-making as far as what projects we do.
But having all of that logistical knowledge over those years probably helps even now getting, you know, projects that you're creatively passionate about.
Absolutely.
Off the ground.
Exactly. And now I can use all of that stuff, all that logistical and all that business expertise that I have honed in the last 10 years. Now I can apply it to projects that I really, really believe in. And that's exciting to me. That's very exciting.
Cool. Well, thank you for taking the time today. Yeah. And congratulations on the Disaster Artist.
Thank you, man.
Thanks for listening to the Road to Cinema podcast. We'll see you next time.